from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Before 1998, it was simply called impotence, and it was often a deep secret. Then came the little blue pill, Viagra. 5 years on, 9 tablets are dispensed every second worldwide. Even Major League Baseball players are talking about erectile dysfunction.
I take batting practice. I take infield practice. I take Viagra.
Now Viagra's not the only game in town. Last month, the FDA approved Levitra, and there are more options coming soon that claim even more potent powers. Tonight on Point, the sexual and cultural phenomenon of the little blue pill listening to Viagra. We begin with a closer examination of the pill's booming sales and marketing. Jane Allen is health writer for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her how big a business Viagra and its cousins are to the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, they're enormously important drugs in part because there's an estimate that about 30 million American men have some level or some form of impotence or difficulty performing sexually, and maybe only 10% of them are being treated. So we're talking about a market right now for Viagra that's been about $1.7 billion worldwide, and about $1 billion of that is in the United States alone. So the folks who are making other drugs, alternatives, are seeing an enormous potential to step into the market.
Other drugs, alternatives, what's coming up?
Well, right now, there are several things in the pipeline, but the biggest thing that's happened is that Viagra was out in the market all by itself, king of the hill, for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we just got FDA approval of a new drug called Levitra. Now, Levitra and Viagra are both drugs in the same class. They work in the same way, and they basically work on blood flow to the penis. So there's the same type of drug. They have similar effects, and they're kind of competing in a way right now to see which works better.
Is the idea in the industry that they'll be competing for this billion-dollar market in the U.S., $1.7 billion worldwide, or that there are many more men who are likely to step up and begin to use these drugs?
Well, I think it's both. I think the first thing that you have to look at is that Viagra kind of took the issue of impotence out of the closet. As you remember, Bob Dole was one of the first people to be a very, you know, well-spoken, good spokesperson or sort of front man for Viagra, talking about what we now call ED, erectile dysfunction.
Who can forget? It made a big impression when it first showed up on
air. Huge impression. And we also medicalized it a little bit more. Instead of using that term impotence, which kind of has maybe some stigma for men and makes them hide the problem, we gave it a medical term. We called it erectile dysfunction. So Bob Dole came out and talked about it. Then we had Rafael Palmeiro, the baseball player, come out. And now we're understanding that Levitra is going to have a spokesperson who will be Mike Ditka, the former NFL football coach. So they're really trying to take this issue and this problem and make it kind of a regular guy's problem. So you can imagine if you see Mike Ditka on TV talking about ED, well, if he's got it and guys who watch football have it, then, you know, this is a regular guy's problem.
Jane, you say 30 million American men could conceivably use the drug, but a much smaller percentage do, maybe 10% in a given year. Is there anything known about who's using it and who's avoiding it?
We really don't know that. I think that, you know, one of the reasons that men shied away from being treated is that in the older days, looking back a few years, the only options were kind of invasive, you know, penile implants, injections into the penis, and men, frankly, didn't want to have to deal with needles and syringes and dealing with something that you had to do right before having sexual activity. What Viagra gave them was a small pill that was a little bit easier to hide, didn't necessarily have to disclose it, and it was a little bit more discreet. And Levitra will do the same thing. It'll be another pill that gives you some discretion, gives you a little bit of flexibility in when you take it, and gives you the option of basically having your sex be a little more spontaneous. What's really interesting on the horizon is a drug that is facing FDA approval or awaiting FDA approval, and that drug is called Cialis. And Cialis could potentially be the biggest and most popular of these drugs because Cialis's effects last for 36 hours. In France, the pill has been called Le Weekend because basically it gives you several opportunities in the course of a weekend to be able to perform sexually, engage in sex with your partner without having to think about using a pill, taking a medication, having a special device.
Jane Allen, walk us through the differences here. Viagra was suggested to be on an empty stomach and it takes longer. What's the difference between Viagra and Levitra, for example?
It's a really interesting question because Viagra basically for most men takes about 30 to 60 minutes to work. You do need to take it on an empty stomach, although it may not say that specifically. It works best when you've had no food in your stomach, and it especially works best with no alcohol. So you're talking about waiting a couple of hours for most men after a meal, after having some drinks. With Levitra, one of its advantages, which seems pretty undisputed or indisputed, is that you can take it with a meal. Now, if your meal is three cheeseburgers and a bunch of fries and it's really fatty, it will impair the drug. But it basically frees you up to take the pill over a nice, you know, meal. You can take it with alcohol, and then potentially you can engage in some fun activities after your meal.
And then Cialis comes along at some point with a 36-hour duration. And what's on down the road from there, Jean Ellen? There's more research going on.
There is more research going on, and there are about three other things that are really close in the pipeline that probably we could see in the next 2 to 3 years. Those include a pill that you could put under your tongue that would dissolve fairly quickly. That's being done by an American company. It's actually available right now in Europe under the name Aprima, and that's awaiting FDA approval, and it bypasses your digestive system going right into the bloodstream, and it works fast, maybe 10 or 20 minutes. There's a nasal spray called PT-141 that somehow when I look at it, I always think of PT-109, but PT-141, also made by an American company in New Jersey, that one is a spray, goes into the nose, it stimulates sexual arousal, and a sniff of that spray could work in about 30 minutes. And then there's one other medication that's being used, and it's a cream. It's a cream that contains a drug called alprostadil, and that's a drug that's been used for years when men were injecting their penises with medication. But here, you put a teeny little drop of the cream on, it dissolves right into the skin, and pretty quickly, and perhaps within a half an hour or less, you are able to have sexual activity again. So these are kind of nice because it gives people options besides taking a pill that has to go through your bloodstream and dissolve before it works. However, what you need to realize is that with Viagra and with Levitra, they do work quickly. In most men, they work in 30 to 60 minutes. One of the interesting points right now is that the companies are kind of competing over who's the fastest. And our friends who make Viagra say that their pills in clinical trials have worked in as little as 14 minutes. The Levitra makers did some studies and found theirs worked in as little as 16 minutes. Now, while this may not be a big race, that certainly could be a marketing point, but in general, men are probably going to see the effects within about 30 to 60 minutes of taking the drug.
Sounds like everybody into the pool. Jean Ellen, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Jean Ellen is health writer for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Los Angeles. So Viagra and its cousins are everywhere and apparently bound to become even more deeply embedded in sexuality and the culture that surrounds it. For men with a problem and their partners, that's a relief. But for all of us, it's another step into the world of enhancement medicine, to new expectations and maybe a new cultural baseline understanding of our most intimate human encounters. Are you in the Viagra vanguard? Has it changed your life? Is it changing our culture and its expectations? How did you get over your embarrassment and step up to the pharmacy counter for the little blue pill? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Antonio is Dr. Abraham Verghese, director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Center, San Antonio. A prolific writer, his essay, The Way We Love Now, appeared in a recent edition of the Wall Street Journal. His latest book is The Tennis Partner. Good evening and welcome, Abraham Verghese.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You caught our eye with your essay and your kind of meditation on, of all things, Viagra. Saying, hey, yes, it's booming, it's all over the place, 500 million of those little blue pills dispensed since it came out in 1998. But it comes with lots of questions and ultimately a kind of a cultural impact that we may still not be fully comprehending. When you look at Viagra as a phenomenon beyond just what happens in the bedroom, Dr. Abraham Verghese, how do you see it? What ripples come from this rock in the pond?
Well, the first thing I should say is that Viagra is a wonderful invention. We've only spent the last 5,000 years looking for a drug that could do just this, and billions of dollars have been spent by people chasing this wonderful effect, which is now available in a pill form. So I don't think we should denigrate what a remarkable achievement this is. But the question I asked in that essay and the question I ask now is, now that we have several drugs like this and they're all competing to see which works faster, longer, less side effects and so on, Does this fundamentally change us as people, as men? Is society somehow going to be altered when all of us are potentially capable of having an erection till our deathbed? In fact, our last breath may well come about from the fact that we're capable of an erection, but our heart is not up to the task.
Right. You describe, of course, this very long pursuit of exactly the kind of effect that Viagra provides now, that that for millennia men have gone to the genitals of goats and tiger parts and rhino horn looking for that magic elixir. Now it's practically ubiquitous.
It's not only ubiquitous, it's also remarkable in that we've sort of dismissed the aspect of mind over matter. We think that a significant amount of erectile dysfunction is actually in the mind. It represents something going wrong in the way you're thinking about sex or the particular situation you're in. But the treatment has become entirely matter over mind. And so we're reaching for a chemical solution to something that's not always clearly a physical problem. It's much more often or very often a psychological problem. So I think we've sort of skipped one beat. And in the widespread use of these drugs, I worry that we're sort of shortchanging the things that might be, say, wrong in a relationship. And we'll discover that just restoring erectile function does not necessarily bring us back to the things, bring us back to an ideal situation in a marriage or a relationship. It might still require other kinds of work.
When you say matter over mind, you're really pointing to the fact, I guess, that in the Viagra era, arousal really isn't even necessarily part of sex. I mean, the sort of physical, everything happens physically, arousal or not, right?
Well, just about. I mean, the watershed moment in this whole story of impotence was ironically or maybe fittingly at a urology conference in Las Vegas when a scientist in 1983 got up to the podium, and just before he spoke, he was a urologist, he had injected himself with a substance into the penis, and during the course of his lecture, he stepped away from the podium. And he demonstrated to his startled colleagues that he had an erection. And this was the first demonstration of matter over mind, that some substance could do this. Now,
well, viva Las Vegas. So he was making the rounds of the convention hall with the flag flying high there.
Absolutely. And evidently people who were there did not forget the lesson there, that this was more than mind over matter. It was clearly a matter of matter, if you will.
But this goes to your point. You could hardly have a less sexual circumstance or environment than a convention hall in Las Vegas or anywhere else for that matter.
Right. But I think the difference with Viagra and these other congeners of Viagra is that, in fact, it does sort of reproduce, in a sense, the normal physiological mechanism in that you don't just get an erection willy-nilly with these drugs. You really have an enhancement of the normal physiological mechanisms when you are aroused. It's not quite like injecting a drug into the penis. You still need some of the other mental and other stimulations to start it going.
A few years back, we heard from Peter Kramer in his book Listening to Prozac about how that enhancement medicine maybe didn't just perk people up, but changed people, maybe in some fundamental way. In some ways, I hear you saying to us tonight, let's listen to Viagra as well. Let's look across the culture and see how it changes. If there's no such thing as golden years that are free of sexuality, that may be a great thing, but it may not necessarily be a great thing.
Yeah, well, I think Peter Kramer's beautiful book really made us look at this phenomenon of people being of achieving some sort of, quotes, better self than their original self, if you will. And the people who are using Viagra now are not just people with erectile dysfunction, but it's getting a lot of use among gay men. It's getting a lot of use as a party pill along with ecstasy and amphetamines. So, I mean, this is not purely a drug for a disease. It's much more than that. It's people trying to enhance what they have, get some advantage, if you will.
Abraham Verghese, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the sexual and cultural phenomenon of Viagra. We're listening to Viagra and its cousins and what they tell us about ourselves. You can join the conversation. Are you in the Viagra vanguard? Has it changed your life? Is it changing our culture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sexual and cultural phenomenon of Viagra and the new crop of sexual enhancement drugs. The new drug on the block, Levitra, was approved by the FDA in August. Ads are already hitting the airwaves.
Sometimes you need a little help staying in the game. Introducing new Levitra. Levitra Vardenafil HCL. It's a new choice, and it's here now. I asked my doctor if a free sample of new Levitra was right for me. You should too. So talk to your doctor today. Ask your doctor about a new choice. Ask about new Levitra.
There's the message, the marketing for Levitra, cousin of Viagra, on the market now, and much more on the way. We're listening to Viagra and its cousins tonight and asking what they tell us about ourselves. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Abraham Verghese, or joined from San Antonio, Texas, I should say, where he is director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Center, San Antonio. His essay, The Way We Love Now, appeared in the recent Wall Street Journal. You can join this conversation tonight. Beyond the obvious, does Viagra change relationships? And on a grand scale, is it changing our society, our culture? Is it changing assumptions about sex and sexuality? Is it an unmitigated good that men can now have sex until they drop? Does Viagra mean that sex is now de rigueur, even for the last of the golden years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Abraham Verghese, I wonder, when you hear the ads that we all hear on radio, on television, there's a message, there's an image, a vision of personality and sexuality coming across in these. How do you interpret it?
Well, you know, I'm struck by one thing. I'm struck by an absence. There isn't a woman in that ad. If these pills are really doing what they should do, then you'd think that the happy, joyful person at the other end would be the one proclaiming its virtues. And I think that's very telling. This is really a lot about the male ego and male performance. It's not necessarily about happy relationships and so on. I still haven't seen one ad where a woman gleefully celebrates her husband's restored potence, which, if you think about it, that should be a common theme in these ads.
That should be with the celebrations. But you're right. I don't think I've ever seen a woman. You say, jokingly, I guess, that it raises a kind of element of doubt, potentially, in women's minds. Paraphrasing Mae West, you say, is that a pill in your gullet, or are you just happy to see me?
Absolutely. I think it changes something for a woman to find out that her partner has taken a pill. You begin to wonder, is it me or is it the pill? Obviously, for couples who have seriously struggled with erectile dysfunction, this is a godsend. But what about the person who gets a few samples over the internet and decides to sort of toy with this on the side? How does the partner perceive that? Do they take part in that decision? The striking absence of an equivalent pill for women, I think, is a very important thing to point out here.
And you raised the question, Abraham Verghese, of what these drugs mean to society and what new myths Viagra and its cousins will propagate. It's a fascinating question. Have you come to answers?
I think we shouldn't believe that technology, even medical technology, is necessarily value neutral. I mean, this is superficially a very simple thing, a pill you swallow. Wonderful effects, but I think that any technology clearly affects society, changes things. A behaviorist would argue that if you have sustained erections, you'll increase the desire as well. And some of the newer pills that your correspondent was talking about actually will increase the desire, the nasal spray and so on that's coming down the pike. We are fundamentally going to change the nature of intimacy between men and women. It's going to be, first of all, a jingle. And secondly, it's going to be very difficult to say what's real and what's not.
Abraham Verghese, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Jennifer Berman. Dr. Jennifer Berman joins us from Los Angeles. She's director of the Female Sexual Medicine Center and assistant professor of urology at UCLA, co-host of Berman and Berman on the Discovery Health Channel. Good evening and welcome, Jennifer Berman.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Abraham Verghese is raising a lot of interesting questions around Viagra and the clones or successors that are coming on the market now. You've paid a lot of attention to this. He raises the possibility of these drugs fundamentally changing sort of quality and texture of sexual relations in our culture globally, I guess. Do you see that happening?
I do see it happening in both a positive way and a negative way. The negative way is that treating erection problems in men, thereby enabling a man to have satisfactory erections without addressing what issues the woman might have, for instance, if they haven't been sexual for a good period of time, and or she is suffering from vaginal dryness or low libido or something else, and then to come forward and say, here I am, I'm ready with my erections, and let's get to it, that can have a quite damaging effect. Now, on the other hand, in a couple that is intimate and has maintained their level of intimacy with some degree of satisfaction, enabling them to have satisfactory sexual relations can be a really, is really welcome and a good thing. So it can have both positive and negative effects.
And what about the picture that Abraham Verghese paints of the later years of life, suddenly being fully colored in with sexuality, whereas they may have been less so before? Is everybody celebrating that, Jennifer Berman, or are there people who look to those years? I don't know, for satisfactions, joys, even ecstasies other than sex.
Well, it brings up a good point that sexuality is, and sexual function is individually defined, and it depends on what the individual and the couple wants. Now, this generation of women, the baby boomers that are now coming into menopause, are a totally different group than probably their mothers. And the ones who, these ladies that spearheaded the women's movement and all these other things are approaching menopause differently than their mothers, and are feeling entitled to sexuality and sexual pleasure, and are not, taking no for an answer, or taking this is just what happens to you when you get old as a solution. And I think it's a different group of people, and that's what's governing this whole heightened awareness and pharmaceutical industry rush to create drugs that enhance sexual vitality, because there's a demand for it.
Abraham Verghese, how do you see that in the senior years? There's a lot of conversation, as Jennifer Berman says, about how welcome this can be. On the other hand, it does sort of change nature's life cycle, or might, I guess. Is this a welcome thing, or is this kind of barbarians at the gate of Golden Pond?
I think it's a very welcome thing. I think that our whole image of aging is changing. We're seeing wonderful, healthy examples of aging and aging sexuality, and this will clearly be an asset. But I think that what has also happened is that sex has become almost the single most important element in many relationships. At least that's the impression you get when you watch TV and you read People magazine and so on. I think that fact, that everything rests on sexuality, and the lack of investment in intimacy, in developing something to celebrate in old age besides consummating this relationship, that loss, I think, was going to affect us in the years to come.
Dr. Abraham Verghese, Dr. Jennifer Berman, stand by. I want to turn to our callers. Ron's calling from Cambridge Springs, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, Tom?
Great, thanks.
I appreciate you taking my call. I just wanted to mention that as a physician, I practice giving some of this or writing for some of these prescriptions. I think that just as a side, if we exclude the medical reasons for impotency, such as diabetes, vascular problems, and whatnot, mm-hmm. and approach the situation with where a male is not able to perform as he used to. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times we need to also work with the relationship itself. We've gotten to a point where we just expect a pill to be an answer to everything. And if the relationships are not intact, all the pills in the world aren't going to help, including Viagra or Levitra. I think it's something that you have to want both, want to experience the intimacy in order to achieve it in fulfillment for each person. And I think that the medications will help, but I think without the desire on both, and certainly on the men's part, all the pills in the world aren't going to do it.
So, Ron, do you see, ironically, the pill in a way as a kind of adding to a kind of centrifugal force that may pull people apart, even as it gives them the capacity to consummate sexuality?
Absolutely. And, in fact, going back to one of our guest speakers just a minute ago mentioned you don't see a lot of women promoting it. I think that a lot of times the woman may feel, my God, if my partner has to have a pill to have an erection, what's my problem?
Yeah, we can easily imagine that. Ron, thanks for your perspective as a prescription writing physician. Jennifer Berman, how common is that? Do you find women coming into sexual relations when Viagra is part of the picture and saying, "Well, gee, you know, am I not enough?"
I mean, absolutely. I think the point is that sexuality and sexual function, and for that matter, dysfunction, is a couple's problem. And treating either the man or the woman independently of the relationship is not doing them any service. And actually, it's an interesting point because a question is why people aren't renewing or men aren't renewing their Viagra prescriptions. If the goal is just to have an erection satisfactory to intercourse, it should be the magic bullet. But as that gentleman said, or that doctor said, it's not.
And are you saying that, in fact, there's a trend where men are not renewing their prescriptions?
There absolutely is, and the question is why. Is it that they require intimacy and love and feeling connected and need to feel good about themselves and their bodies and everything else the way women do? Is it the fact that the Viagra is not working? It doesn't appear to be the case. There is obviously more to sex than just intercourse for both men as well as women.
The human psyche is so fantastically
right.
Subtle and complicated, and we hear everybody saying tonight, if you need it, it works and great for you, but it's also, of course, a subtle landscape out there. Abraham Verghese, Jennifer Berman, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Dr. Peter Kramer. He joins us tonight from Providence, Rhode Island. He's clinical professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University and author of Listening to Prozac. Good evening and welcome, Peter Kramer.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Peter Kramer, you made a huge splash when you came out, 10 years ago?
10 years.
10 years with Listening to Prozac. You saw patients who were taking this drug. You welcomed it at many levels, but you also asked some tough questions about the essence of personhood and the philosophical implications of using drugs to alter personality. When you look out at the whole Viagra bandwagon, do you see a parallel here? Do you see the same kinds of questions as potentially arising out of the Viagra nation?
Clearly there are parallels. Here's something that on the face of it is a boon to mankind. There is medical impotence. You give a erectile dysfunction. You have a treatment for it. As Dr. Verghese says, we've been looking for this for eons. On the other hand, if you look back to mid-century, if someone was impotent, the therapist would say, Rollo May, the existential therapist, would say, your mm-hmm. penis may be smarter than you are. Perhaps there's something you should explore about the nature of the relationship, and if you do that, you'll find out where your ambivalence lies and your potency will return. Now, of course, there was something a little bit disingenuous about that. When the only tool you have is psychotherapy, of course, everything looks like a target for it.
Right.
But I think there is something eerie about cutting the Gordian knot and just going right through to the end, to the performance issue and having a medical treatment for it.
And Abraham Verghese, is this your point, that at some level this gets right to the nub of the human psyche and uncouples us from it? It's not necessary to be at grips with it.
Precisely. I think that, Peter said it very well. You're arriving at a solution without having worked out some of the issues that are fundamental to your happiness. It's, sex is much more than just having an erection, although you wouldn't think that from reading the tabloids, but it is.
I want to get another call in. Julie's calling from Spooner, Wisconsin. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
My comment is that women have felt pressured for decades to live up to an unrealistic standard of sexuality. And so women are having their breasts tucked and implants put in and their teeth whitened. And I'm wondering if this is our culture's way of making some men in there who are normal, functioning in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, to raise a standard to something unrealistic and make them feel pressured to take other kinds of means to reach that unrealistic standard.
Julie, how does Viagra come into that pressure in your mind? What's the connection?
Well, for example, if a man is dating and he's in his 50s and he finds out that the woman that he's dating, the last couple of partners she had, used Viagra, he might feel pressured that he needs to use it in order to meet that kind of standard.
So, and just wait until they get the 36-hour pill. My gosh, the pressure will really be on. But, Julie, we get the observation. We thank you for it. Jennifer Berman, do you see that happening, a kind of new comparative ranking or new resetting of expectations?
Well, it's expectations for women and from women. I mean, the whole thing with Sex and the City and women need to be swinging from the chandeliers every time they have an orgasm is unrealistic. And a lot of what we do is educating women on what is normal and what they can expect, and we should have realistic expectations. The point is that when you're not satisfied with your sexual life, if there are medical reasons why you're having vaginal dryness, pain, low libido, difficulty achieving orgasm, whatever it is, and there's medical reasons for that, and there are potential treatments available, then those, and you are interested in restoring that, then those are the people that seek treatment and that, you know, deserve it, and that these drugs such as Viagra, Levitra, and testosterone, and anything else that's being developed, will benefit from.
Peter Kramer, you listened to Prozac, and you said this is really important and good for people for whom it alleviates illness. At the same time, you raise these questions. I mean, there's a little bit of a critical tinge here tonight. At the same time, it's important to recognize that for people who just have a flat-out mechanical problem here, if it can ever be that simple, and I guess it can get with some disease, this is awfully important. This is liberating. But, Dr. Kramer, I wonder, how then do you separate? You drew a line with Prozac, or at least made distinctions between necessary good treatment and something that sort of led to a disassociation from self.
I think what's important with these new technologies is specifying what makes us pleased and what makes us uneasy about them. I think the caller gave us one source of unease. It's what ethicists call implicit coercion, that once something is possible, there's pressure to actually do it. The standards changed. And, of course, there's this other source of unease, which is that the purveyor of this new good is some corporation. And if we, you know, had discovered that some easily available vitamin or plant substance did the same thing, we might be much more comfortable about it. But anyway, I think these technologies get us to ask what exactly is the source of our unease. And yes, I mean, on the face of it, this is a wonderful thing. It's not just illness, it's aging. We, you know, going back to Jonathan Swift, there's a question of if you lengthen life, are you actually going to accompany that with some continuing quality of life? And I think most people would say that active sexuality is, you know, an important part of the ordinary good quality of life.
So as we're extending life, here it comes along. It's very useful. And at the same time, the whole issue has been raised of how exactly it changes the way we think about ourselves and about each other, about relationships. Doctors Abraham Verghese, Jennifer Berman, and Peter Kramer, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the sexual and cultural phenomenon of Viagra. We're listening to Viagra and its cousins and what they tell us about ourselves. You can join the conversation. Are you in the Viagra vanguard? Has it changed your life? Is it changing our culture? And what does the Viagra boom tell us about ourselves? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sexual and cultural phenomenon of Viagra, listening to Viagra and its cousins and what they tell us about ourselves. You can join the conversation. Beyond the obvious, does Viagra change relationships? And on a grand scale, is it changing society? Is it changing assumptions about sex and sexuality? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight from San Antonio, Texas, Dr. Abraham Verghese, Director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Center, San Antonio. From Los Angeles, Dr. Jennifer Berman, Director of the Female Sexual Medicine Center and Assistant Professor of Urology at UCLA. And joining us tonight from Providence, Rhode Island, Dr. Peter Kramer, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at Brown University and author of Listening to Prozac. Right now, Robert's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment actually pertains to how, studies that show that with sexual release, with release of that kind of tension,
yep,
that general well-being is generally increased.
Okay.
So with this drug that's helping people to actually achieve that release, so to say, it would theoretically be increasing general well-being in people and potentially society.
So you're saying, what's wrong with that? People are going to feel better, period.
Right.
Robert, have you used Viagra?
No, I haven't.
But if you needed it, it sounds like you wouldn't hesitate.
Well, if it came to that point and there was, I would actually go to counseling first, because I have a little bit of a background in psychology here. Generally, what I would do.
But Viagra takes 30 minutes and counseling takes longer. There might be circumstances where Viagra came first. But we've got the point, Robert. Thanks for the call. Abraham Verghese, what about it? I mean, your conclusion here in your Wall Street Journal essay is that we may one day marvel at the poignancy and purity of intimacy before the hype of these pills made it into a jingle. And yet, Robert says, hey, let's remember, there's a simple need here, and it can bring joy and comfort.
Well, I think it's telling that Pfizer, for example, spent $100 million promoting this drug when they had no competition. I mean, theoretically, they had just built the better mousetrap. Everyone should have been beating a path to their door. And people keep touting this figure of 30 million people out there with erectile dysfunction who have to be coaxed into the doctor's office. I don't think that's entirely true. I think these drugs, I prescribe them as a physician running an AIDS clinic or seeing an HIV population. I prescribe them, and they're not perfect. You have headache the next day. You have stuffy nose. Some people have wheezing. It interacts with many medications. And often the fundamental reason we're prescribing them is because someone is on Prozac-like drugs which produce this kind of erectile dysfunction. So this is by no means a magic bullet. But for the few individuals who have a discrete problem and for whom this produces the release, as your listener described it, I think it's wonderful.
Peter Kramer, there's the point where Viagra intersects directly with the drug you've written about, Prozac, and others in that family, where sexual function may be impaired by those mood-altering drugs. And so what, do we see people doubling up here? Is Viagra kind of a couplet?
Let's take two half steps back. First, I should say what a pleasure it is always to be involved in a program with Dr. Abraham Verghese,
who is
one of our great medical authors and a friend of mine. And also to take half a step back to the caller and say that he does raise this odd question of the function of sexuality. You know, the worry a woman may have about how she's being used precedes Viagra, and whether she is just a sort of vessel for sexual release and general good glow, or whether there's intimacy, is really a question that may be heightened by these medicines, but it certainly stands independent of them. Yes, one of the side effects of the antidepressants is loss of sexual interest or difficulty with erections. And, again, in their classic use, these antidepressants are absolutely necessary. They're life-saving. They're transformative, through treating legitimate illnesses. And then if someone really has to be on these medicines for a long time, the antidepressants, and depression certainly can be a chronic illness, it's good to have something that counteracts their side effects. But then you can certainly end up with a layering of medicines, a layering of side effects, and at a certain point you wish for some other means of treating each of these problems.
A kind of matrix of interacting drugs there. And Jennifer Berman, the other point that Abraham Verghese raises here is something like a commodification of sexuality. If all those jingles are intended to weld sex and Viagra together, if, I don't know what it is, $10 a pop or something like that, does this pull sex into the realm of commodity, in that it's a purchase that facilitates it?
I guess, I mean, you can look at it either way, but from my perspective, if, it's the question is, are we medicalizing, problems that are part of nature or that may or may not be psychologically or emotionally based? And the question is, again, goes back to the point, if there is a medical or physical reason why people might be experiencing sexual function complaints and there is a medical treatment that might help that, then I'm in support of that. We treat a variety of medical conditions with medications and don't have issues with that, and a variety of quality of life issues, including depression with medications. And sexual dysfunction and sexual problems are a major quality of life problem, and if there is a medical intervention that can help it, obviously it's not necessarily a magic bullet, but it should be welcome.
Yeah, I guess I don't hear anybody exactly questioning that tonight, but there's some interesting terrain that it creates around that path. Angelica's calling from Wildwood, Illinois. Hi, Angelica. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a couple points. I think that we keep going back in circles about the benefits to the people that are taking it and the reasonings behind it, and I'm sure it's helped a lot of people. But I know of one couple specifically that after a 35-year marriage, the husband finally discovered Viagra, and all of a sudden his wife was not able to keep up with the pill, and she was very quickly replaced. And you know, the impact that a divorce has in a family at that point in life, at that age, is definitely devastating to adult children. It makes you question, you know, what the marriage was based on in the first place. And I think that, you know, for the people that it helps for, you know, medical reasons and that sort of thing, that's one thing. But, you know, there's the other side of it, that it's an incredibly self-gratifying act to take this pill, and that when it's not about the relationship and it's just about what you want to accomplish mm-hmm. for yourself. And I think that it kind of validates that the self-gratification is the bigger goal, and that's why you only see men in the ads and you see like one-on-one monologues on the ads.
So your friend's husband got very sexually interested and active, and she just wasn't able or interested in keeping up. That was the end of the marriage.
Right.
Well,
and I think that the other point that I'm surprised it has not been brought up is that, I mean, historically I think that men have used sex to victimize and control and subdue women, and I think that's leveled some after, you know, in more recent years. But I think that this bill is going to allow men to continue to do that even in older age. And also the other point I wanted to make is that there's also an illegal market for it. The person that I was talking about earlier in this marriage actually was able to obtain these pills illegally. And there's the, you know, I have personally a concern that, you know, people like sexual offenders and, you know, child molesters and people with other kinds of problems would be able to get a hold of them. And then, you know.
Yeah, we hear it. Angelica, we've got it. It's made a big splash in your world. Abraham Verghese, how do you respond?
I think she raises an excellent point that, you know, it's not quite as simple as taking a pill for erectile dysfunction. There's complex issues. For example, a recent study in the Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndromes showed that gay men who recently used Viagra were more likely to be HIV positive, more likely to have had unprotected anal sexual intercourse. So this is not all about restoring relationships. A lot of it is about selfish use and restoring potency for a very sort of self-serving purpose. And I think that the drug company advertisements are really quite disingenuous. The suggestion that there's all these shy men out there, mm-hmm. too red-faced to talk to their doctors about erectile dysfunction, and you know, Mike Ditka has to coax them in. I don't think really that we're appealing to that population. We're catering to a certain degree of self-interest and selfishness that can manifest with a pill like this, in the disastrous way that that your caller just described.
A kind of encouragement that goes beyond nature in some way, and I guess that's what a pill is in the first place. Well, what a fascinating hour, both in the support for Viagra and all the questions and light shed around it, all the issues that it raises. It's been terrific. Abraham Verghese, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Thanks very much for your essay and for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It was great to be on with all of you and with Peter especially.
Dr. Abraham Verghese, Director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Center in San Antonio, and Jennifer Berman in Los Angeles, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Berman, Director of the Female Sexual Medicine Center at UCLA, and Dr. Peter Kramer in Providence, Rhode Island, author of Listening to Prozac. Great to have you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks.
Peter Kramer, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at Brown University. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, General Wesley Clark throws his brass hat into the presidential ring. This is On Point. As expected, the crowded field of candidates seeking to challenge President Bush next year gained another contender today as former NATO commander General Wesley Clark joined the race. In a speech announcing his candidacy, Clark offered few specifics, but he offered to lay out his economic, he vowed to lay out his economic and foreign policies in major speeches over the coming weeks. On Point has been bringing you excerpts of all the candidates' formal declaration speeches. Here is General Wesley Clark speaking earlier today in Little Rock, Arkansas.
These are historic times, and we're going to run a campaign that's worthy of the historic times in which we live. We're going to run a campaign that will move this country forward, not back. And we're going to talk straight to the American people, because in times of great historic challenges, the American people deserve to hear the truth and hear it in plain and simple language. Yeah. And in this campaign, we're going to bring people together in the great tradition of the Democratic Party, because now we need leaders, more than ever before, leaders who will put the best interests of all our people first. And when I say we're going to bring people together, I mean all our people, not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans, too. And especially those who have never participated before. You'll come with us. Now, I warn you, we'll ask the tough questions as we move forward, and we'll hold this administration accountable. Yeah. Why has America lost 2.7 million jobs? Why has America lost the prospect of a $5 trillion surplus and turned it into a $5 trillion deficit that deepens every day? Why has our country lost our sense of security and feels the shadow of fear? Why are so many here in America hesitant to speak out and ask questions? Well, we're going to ask those hard questions, my friends, and we're going to demand the answers. But we're going to do so not in destructive bickering or in personal attacks, but in the highest tradition of democratic dialogue. We're going to seek out the facts, to search for the causes, to find the solutions. And in questioning and proposing alternatives, we're going to reach to the very essence of our democracy. And in a time of war, we're going to ask those questions and propose those alternatives in the highest sense of patriotism.
General Wesley Clark announcing his entry into the 2004 presidential race earlier today in Little Rock, Arkansas. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.